The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. What a ridiculous couple of days of Champions League football. Manchester United win in Paris, Rashford's composure, no one knowing the handball law, Buffon showing his age and PSG slipping up again. Sergio Ramos intentionally suspended, watching on while Real Madrid capitulate to an inspired Dusan Tadic and Ajax. Is Jose really going to take over at the Bernabeu? Spurs do the job in Dortmund, there's more VAR and a glorious rutting headbutt as Porto see off Roma. We'll talk to Der Spiegel about the latest FFP allegations against Manchester City. We'll congratulate England's ladies for winning the She Believes Cup. I'll beg Americans for forgiveness for getting my Caldwells in a muddle. We'll take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning. I couldn't help notice in that intro you missed on them winning in the Checkered Trade semi-final. Are we doing an extra pod on that? Is that why?
Yeah, there's going to be a bonus hour after this pod. If you could, you and Barry together and two other famous Sunderland fans who are...
Steve Cram and Kate Adie.
Steve Cram and Kate Adie will do the Sunderland Checkered Trade pod. And then we'll do an hour on Portsmouth with famous Portsmouth fans.
The antiquarian bookseller with the bell.
Yeah, Mr. Pompey.
Yeah. And Luke Moore from the Football Ramble.
Yes.
And I can't think.
Admiral Nelson, the Roman Emperor Pompey.
Lord Admiral Nelson will join as well.
Arthur Conan Doyle played for them.
Did he?
Yeah, to dig up his corpse and see what he thinks. He was into spiritualism and seances and that.
Was he?
He'd be well up for it.
Okay. Well, we'll give him a go. Producer Jonathan's saying there's quite a lot to get through in this pod. Maybe we shouldn't have exhumed Sir Arthur Conan Doyle this early. Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm good.
Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to be here.
Barry Glendenning, hello.
Yes, hi.
I've already said
my bit.
You have, and you weren't introduced. What poor form. Anyway, let's start then. In Paris, PSG 1, Manchester United 3. Manchester United, the first team ever to lose their Champions League knockout tie first leg at home by two goals or more and still managed to qualify. The other 34 teams who found themselves in that position failed. It was an amazing last minute, Barry, that went on for 8 minutes. Amazing composure from Rashford and VAR.
Yeah, well, I presume everyone knows what's happened at this point, and I think we have to begin any conversation about this with the caveat that because it happened to PSG, it's incredibly funny because they're quite possibly the most objectionable football club in the world. Now, a lot of people have been on the Twitter and I think they're eager to hear what I have to say about this latest bottle job. And I think if it was any other team, you could say, God, they were extraordinarily unlucky, because personally, I can see why the VAR decision was given. It's not one I would have given. We've had this discussion before. The law is subjective, and that was the referee's interpretation. And apparently it's the direction refs have been steered in. I don't personally want to get involved in a tedious debate over whether it was handball or not. But because it was PSG and they have form in the field of mental disintegration in European competition, you kind of wonder, well, you know, they were 2-0 up from the first leg. They were playing at home in front of a partisan crowd against a team that had 10 players out with injury and finished with, you know, several kids on the pitch. They had chance after chance after chance they wasted. You got to say, you know, if you were going to put your money on any team being the first to mess up from that situation, who would it be? You got to say Paris Saint-Germain.
Do you have any sympathy for PSG, Paolo?
there's separate things going on here. I mean, I certainly understand Baz's feeling on, you know, them as a club and the way they've been run. Of course, there are lots of people who have supported Paris Saint-Germain since long before Qatari money got involved in the club.
Well, not that long before. I mean, it was only invented in 1970. So,
right. It's still a reason. Well, you know, it's longer than I've been alive.
Paolo doesn't have BC and AD. Yeah. BP
that's
and it, AP.
That's all that exists. But also individual footballers who are simply having their careers. I think that, of course, you know, the narrative is now very easy to sort of build from here to the Barcelona game of the team that always bottles it in on big European nights. Obviously blowing a 4-0 lead against Barcelona at the Camp Nou. I think on that occasion, they had sort of a legitimate call to injustice, personally. They should have had a penalty themselves in that game, which they didn't get. And then Luis Suarez dives for a penalty at the other end, and it goes. And that gets forgotten in the end. In the end, what happens is they bottled it, when actually they bottled it because they had a penalty given against them that should never have been. But it was sort of an extraordinary performance, in as much as they were throughout this game quite compelling going forwards. And I saw someone on Twitter, and I apologies to them because I can't remember who it was. Someone on Twitter sort of described them as a team that is always playing as though it's either losing 1-0 or winning 3-0. And they are a bit, aren't they, this season? I mean, they don't seem to have like an in-between manage the game mode. It's that they only think that they have to sort of attack, and they're scintillating when they attack. And, you know, if Kylian Mbappe keeps his feet when he's going through on goal, or I don't know, one of many other chances in that game, then they win, and it doesn't matter. But the sort of the lack of control in the performance is striking, and was true in that defeat to Barcelona as well. Even if they were unlucky with the refereeing decisions in that game, the lack of control does seem to be a constant under different managers, different sort of eras with this periods for this club. They still always seem to just lack control in these big moments, and for that reason, yeah, you don't feel that much sympathy for them. You think, well, you were 2-0 up at home, you should have managed the game.
Look, I know Barry doesn't want to get in. I understand the idea of debating whether a handball's not a handball or is a handball, but in the papers today, Peter Walton, former Premier League referee, is saying that is a penalty, right? Yeah. And Mark Clattenburg is saying that shouldn't be a penalty, right? He's saying by the laws that UEFA want them interpreted, it is. And for me, I don't know, and I don't know if I'm just being ridiculous. That isn't a penalty, just in my mind. It's not a penalty.
It's entirely a matter of opinion, and I can totally see why you think it isn't. I can also see why other people think it is. That's why debating the matter is completely futile.
But can you not debate the handball law itself? Because
it needs to be changed.
This
was something Peter Walton actually said on BT sort of later last night, which I found interesting. Is he basically said that under the directives, clearly as he understands, you said Clattenburg disagrees, but as he understands them and has been, I certainly would say this is how I've seen it applied all across Europe this year, that is a handball, and there is a disconnect between what players and fans think is a handball and what referees are being told is a handball. So under his criteria it is. But what he actually said, which I thought was interesting, is that IFAB is planning to write out, they're planning to remove the word deliberate from the law, because as Walton said, it's impossible for a referee to know what's deliberate and what isn't. I mean, some situations you might think it looks obvious, a player's like thrown his hand at the ball or not. But you're asking a referee to be a mind reader, which isn't fair. So they are planning to simplify the criteria.
I'm not sure that's true. I think they're taking out deliberate when it stops a goal or when it creates or scores a goal. I think deliberate will still remain. It's going to then define what deliberate means. I think, look, Under the guidelines that referees have been given, I think this is pretty obviously a penalty, because we're told the Otamendi one 2 weeks ago was a penalty. Mm-hmm. This is 100 times a penalty that was, because Otamendi's hand was literally by his side as he pulled it away. This, the arm is raised slightly.
How strange, because I thought the Otamendi one definitely was, and I thought this wasn't. Maybe I'm just completely wrong.
But what I would also say here, and you know, I think you're always going to have a grey area, but how far does the hand have to be away from the body before that's making it bigger? What to me made this look worse, I mean, okay, not to you, but what made this look worse is he's turned his back. And that's just disgracefully bad defending. So although he may be unlucky with the call, I don't think he is in the present interpretation of the law, but he's not unlucky in that he's turned his back on it. Turn your back.
Should we get an objective view from Neymar? As Richard writes, we've seen Neymar acting on the pitch. Nice to see him off the pitch pretending he actually has any passion for this club. Neymar on Instagram and parental advisory. He said, "This is a disgrace. They put four people that know nothing about football in charge of looking at the replay for VAR. There is no penalty. How can it be a handball when it hits his back? Go fuck yourselves." Right, didn't hit his back, did it? And Daniel says, "Do all referees who officiate when Buffon's team is playing in the Champions League knockout stages have municipal garbage bins for hearts?" I mean, Buffon let himself down, didn't he, last night?
Yeah, the second goal, he was absolutely at fault on. Spilled it. I actually thought he got pretty close to that penalty, which was a very well struck penalty at the end, which would have been a way to change the narrative. But Gigi Buffon has been, in my opinion, as someone who's just sort of made it clear that football didn't exist before I was born. he's the best goalkeeper I've watched in my lifetime, is my opinion, and the length of time he's played is part of that. But I don't think at 41 he is any longer at the peak of his powers. And perhaps whilst it was an interesting idea to bring him in for a year and see if he could sort of offer something to the squad, and I'm certain, because I've spoken to a PSG who think he has, that there are lots of people there who believe he has brought something to the squad. I don't think he's I think this probably should be a one-year experiment, and they should be moving on next year.
He is supposed to be signing a new contract this week, an extension. And also, interestingly, the first order of business at Thomas Tuchel's pre-match press conference was who would be starting in goal for PSG. There seemed to be some speculation that it wouldn't be Buffon, but it was, and he made one of the critical errors.
I just thought it was such a bad mistake for that second goal. And, you know, PSG rotating keepers. Maybe rotating keepers isn't a bad thing because it never happens. Yeah, you think it's a bad thing.
And
right?
I mean, look, I've spoken to Buffon about this at length, actually. Like, you know, the idea that great goalkeepers aren't ever permitted to make mistakes is ludicrous. Every great goalkeeper has in their back catalogue a number of mistakes that are glaring, because if you play enough games, you're going to. The point is, do you make a lot of them over time, or do you make very few of them over time? He hasn't got, for the number of games he's played, he's got a pretty good ratio. But is he making more of them as he gets older? I think probably I'd say that he is, yeah.
It's a really fun game.
Yeah, and I think Solskjaer deserves an enormous amount of credit. Obviously, things broke his way. Obviously, United did get lucky. You know, they presented with two goals and then they get a penalty, which was a... There's questions of being asked about it. But... You know, Paolo talked about control, and that's how what Solskjaer did is how you control the game. He gave Manchester United the best conceivable chance they had of winning that game. He probably got it wrong playing Bailly at right back, and then presumably he'd have taken him off at half time if he hadn't been injured anyway. But then in the second half, PSG, you know, he's got himself in a position slightly fortuitously where United need one goal to go through. First 10 minutes of the second half, PSG are on top, and he shifts to a 5-4-1. And says, right, we'll hold this. In the last 10 minutes, we'll have a go and then see what you're made of. And actually, nothing happened that final 10 minutes at all until Dalot has the shot that is going miles over that wins them a penalty.
United only had five shots.
But he put himself in the position. Yeah. They put themselves in that position. It's exactly what George Graham did at Anfield in 1989 of keep it tight for first half, see where we are, see what happens. And that's, you know, United clearly were not the better team over two legs. But they gave themselves a chance they probably shouldn't have had to win it, and then took it.
Five shots for United in the game. Lukaku's goal, Rashford's shot, which led to Lukaku's second goal. The shot of Diogo Dalot that led to the penalty, and the penalty.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And there is a certain delicious irony that Solskjaer's greatest triumph as Manchester United manager so far, and the one that has everyone calling for him to be given the job right now, I don't think there's any need, you know, to do that. He wants the job. There's no rush. Give it to him whenever. His greatest triumph came from a game in which he employed the kind of tactics that Jose Mourinho would have been heroically proud of.
I would have loved it if he'd won that with 19% possession. They've repeated what Mourinho did in Barcelona.
Oh, yeah.
But he let himself, one moment, had 13% possession, was still leading 2-1. But he let themselves down by having too much of the ball second half. But never mind, he can't have everything. He's learning, the young man.
Because you mentioned Dalot there, who I thought was very good after he came on, and that, of course, happened against Southampton as well, wasn't it? He came on and changed the game against Southampton. But this was a mistake in his starting lineup. I mean, Eric Bailly at right back was very bad to begin the game. But I suppose credit to Solskjaer for being a manager who makes change before half time when he sees that's happening.
Well, was that a tactical change or was he injured?
Well, yeah, I suppose that was ambiguous. It felt like the sort of injury that you get when things are going very badly. Yeah. But yeah.
What I thought was genius from Solskjaer as well was to bring on those youngsters at the end. In a way, I was sort of thinking, well, if they don't go through, he's blooded some youngsters. It's all for the future. And if they do, he finishes the game with like these kids that no one's ever heard of on the pitch.
It's such a Ferguson thing of like, please let one of these be Federico Makeda.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it turns out they weren't quite, but still they were there.
Exactly right. And,
you know, Scott McTominay was outstanding. Him, Pereira, you know, poor old Fred was a hero.
Well, I mean, this, you know, in 20 years' time, somebody says to you, you remember when United pulled off that result in Paris? What was the midfield? Like anybody who could say McTominay, Fred, Pereira, Ashley Young. Yeah. I mean,
you can't not question PSG's mettle when they can't be that team, having been two goals up.
But you saw the way that they don't like, they can't deal with being challenged. They can't deal with being challenged. In the first 15 seconds, Pereira went in slightly late on Dani Alves. And there was nothing, you know, it was a foul, but it was nothing particularly serious. And Dani Alves was up and wagging his finger and shaking his head as if, you know, don't you do that to me. You can't do that to us. Then the same when, who was it? Marquinhos got sort of a hand in the upper chest from McTominay.
Oh, God, yeah.
Are you suggesting a team from Paris may be some way haughty and arrogant?
Well, I think maybe I am doing that.
Does anyone else?
And, yeah, they every time they were put under the slightest bit of pressure, they panicked. I mean, where does the first goal come from? A terrible pass. Where does the second goal come from? You know, some awful play allowing Rashford the shot and then a goalkeeping error. Where does the third goal come from? From a huge space opening in front of Dalot and then Kimpembe turns back. I mean, Kimpembe was terrible. Kerr was terrible. I thought Kimpembe was terrible in the first leg. And yeah, should have had, I think he committed three yellow card offences and only got one yellow.
I saw a bunch of, I feel like several people I've seen in the press asking, what's the Norwegian for football, bloody hell? So I texted Lars Sivertsen to get an answer. So in case anyone was wondering this, and apologies for murdering it, football, fine I helvete.
Thank you so much. And thanks, Lars, for your input. Borussia Dortmund 0, Tottenham 1. Great defensive display from Spurs, Jonathan, I thought. I mean, some of it was last ditch, and Dortmund played very well in the first half, but Spurs...
Yeah, I mean, like, I was watching the other game, so this is what I saw in highlights, but it seemed what we might generously call a very professional European performance. They held out, maybe rode the luck a bit, and then when they got the chance, they took it.
Pochettino's getting some credit comparing to the game against Juventus in the Champions League last year, where Juventus made a change and he didn't react... That he realised that Dortmund had too much, and so he changed, I think, to a 5-4-1, pushed Son sort of back on the left a bit, and showed that he is learning as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's always been the question over Spurs, that they do have this, I mean, whether this is Spursiness, ask Barney, I don't know, but they do have a tendency for sloppiness at key moments, and that was what cost them in the Juve game last year when... Yeah, they'd basically let in four goals, and it was 10 minutes in either leg when they played poorly, and they let in four goals in that period, and were probably on top for the other 160 minutes. Whereas here, you know, they withstood the pressure and were ruthless.
How good is Jan Vertonghen? Do we underrate him? Do we rate him the right amount? He made an amazing tackle in this game. He was brilliant in the first leg, playing at left wing back.
He seems to suffer because people think Toby Alderweireld is a lot better. I don't know who's better, but Jan Vertonghen seems to put in more constantly impressive displays. I mean, he had one goal-saving tackle early in this game, and Tottenham were really under the cosh for the first half. He had a goal-saving tackle. Hugo Lloris had an excellent game, made some outstanding saves, and he's been quite erratic this season. Is Jan Vertonghen underrated? I don't think so. I just think he's not rated as highly as some defenders that perhaps he is as good as.
And Harry Kane is very good at that, Paolo. He's come back from injury. He's built, you know, why he's good is he's good at every part of the game, but he hasn't been brilliant since he's come back at that. But where Dortmund were wasteful, he was exactly what he needed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I agree with Baz that it seemed like at the beginning of this game, Dortmund were on top, and you think, oh, if they'd scored, then it's a change of thing. But it was always the situation for Tottenham, because they'd won 3-0 in the first leg, that one goal really was going to kill it. And you feel like you can count on Kane for that goal, and that's such a, yeah.
And a great through ball from Sissoko, who was everywhere, who is just one of my favourite footballers. He's a total joy. You don't know exactly what's going to happen, but I would hate to play against him.
The thing that I most admire about Sissoko is how habitually terrible he was against Sunderland. Every single game he was terrible against Sunderland. And that, to me, is the mark of a truly great player. He knows when to turn it on, and he knows when to turn it off.
Probably not a disaster for Dortmund. They can focus on the league if any team ever needed to focus on the league.
I mean, that's going, I would be wrong for them, isn't it?
It is, yes. But they don't have a distraction now. And a two-game touchline ban for Maurizio Pochettino. I wonder if he'll come out and tell us what Mike Dean said now. It seems... I don't know if that's harsh. It seems like other managers have done that without getting a touchline ban. But
I think it's an extraordinary punishment, very unfair. I don't know. As you say, we don't know what was said, but will it come out in a report? Will there be? Don't they?
I don't know. It depends if Spurs appeal, I guess. Spurs said Spurs weren't going to challenge the punishment. I don't know if they are now, considering the punishment is harsher. He'll miss Southampton at St Mary's on Saturday and the Liverpool game at Anfield on the 31st of March. But you can sit in the stand. I don't understand why managers are on the touchline anyway. You can't see the shape of the game at all.
Well, I mean, it used to be quite a common thing. I mean, Bob Paisley would always spend at least the first half sat in the stand, but it seems to be something that nobody ever does anymore.
Nice when they had a phone as well, an old school phone. That'll do for part one. In part two, we will start with Ajax's amazing win in Madrid.
It's time to focus.
Well, I think that Democrats are going to have to contend with the fact that everything is about Donald Trump.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We look forward to seeing you all on the 15th of March at Earth in Hackney. Me, Barry, Greg Bukowski, David Squires. Two more shows we've just announced. Tickets selling fast on the 22nd of April at SWG3 in Glasgow. Fitbar Corner Live, Barry, featuring you, Ewan Murray, and you, Jonathan Wilson.
Yes.
Why should people come?
I have no idea. It baffles me that they do. But, you know, keep coming. It's great.
Yeah, we have a nice time. Well sold. But, there.
But genuinely, why do people want to come and watch us sit on the stage and talk about football? Got no idea.
Because of all the secrets, the secret things they don't get from the pod.
Oh, that's, yeah, you're right.
Exactly.
Yeah. I just want loads of angry Celtic fans and Rangers fans to come. Unite as one in shouting abuse at Ewan Murray and telling him to stick to the golf.
Can we can we have some bit of netting in front of the stage so they don't chuck stuff at us?
Scottish football fans would never throw anything at anyone.
I love all Scottish football fans, and I would like to be the one that loves you when everyone else is selling this show by criticising the people coming to the show
at all.
23rd of April, the day after, we'll be at Elmwood Hall in Belfast. Me, you, Barry, you and Murray again, and Lars Sivertsen joins us for that. Please come along. Real Madrid 1, Ajax 4. Let's focus first on Ajax, and we can do that with Bart Vlietstra, Dutch football expert from the Dutch Guardian, the Volkskrant. Bart, thanks for coming on. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Loved watching Ajax. I mean, it could have been eight, couldn't it? Were you surprised by how well they played?
In a way, because this was even better than how they played in Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam, they played an absolute quality match. I mean, the best I've seen them play this season, although in the Champions League, they seem to... They seem to put something extra on it. We've seen that against Bayern Munich as well. And, they could do it again. And it was a couple of days before the first match in Amsterdam. They played really the worst game ever against Heracles. They lost 1-0. Heracles is a really small club in Holland. It's like Watford, even smaller. So nobody had the highest expectations of the team. But in the Champions League, something magic happens with this team. That's for sure. And I talked to Hakim Ziyech, one of the big players, who scored the first goal and also scored in Amsterdam. Yeah, he says we have another motivation when we play Champions League. This is the level we all want to play for. And that the hunger of this team, lifts them up in these occasions.
How's the result being viewed, like in the history of Ajax? I spoke to Ronald de Boer yesterday, who said it was up there with winning the thing in 95 in a game he was playing in.
Yeah, I think that's too much. But in 95, that team was on such a high level. It was also quite unexpected, but they won the whole thing. I mean, they're only in the quarterfinals now, which is much further than expected. And they played, of course, some first rounds for qualification first. So that's totally unexpected. But to be honest, Real Madrid wasn't in their best shapes and isn't the Real Madrid that it was in the previous year. So I disagree on Ronald on that. I think winning it was bigger in 95.
What have you done to Dusan Tadic? I mean, you've turned him into Zidane. The English football fans watching going, we knew he was quite good, but we've never seen him do that.
No, and we haven't seen him play that well in the Dutch league as well. So, it was really his big aim to shine some more times in the Champions League. That's why he went to Ajax, because he knew I have the chance now to accelerate. I knew I won't have to be afraid that my position will be taken by another guy. He gets a lot of trust from that. He has a free role as a central striker in these matches, and that's doing him good. And he also said, I left the Premier League because it's so tough, and I want to play till I'm 40. And when I play in the Premier League, I know I will have to end my career in a couple of years. That's what he didn't want, and that's the advantage maybe for Ajax, that they don't have these really super tough matches in the Eredivisie as the Premier League clubs and the other clubs in top European leagues have. So that's why I think he became so good, because he can rest more and he hasn't a big confrontation two times a week.
You touched on Madrid coming into this game on bad results, and I suppose it was the opposite for Ajax, who walloped Feyenoord 3-0 just a few days before. But of course, it was only at the end of January when they were getting was a 6-2 defeat to Feyenoord. How has the team, I guess, because it feels like there's been a turnaround at Ajax, especially in the last month, just in terms of form, and they've really been winning emphatically most weeks. What's happened that's, I don't know, allowed them to do that?
I think it's what I said before, the quote from Ziyech saying, well, this is the level we want to perform, and that's where we put everything in it that we have. And there's so much creativity in this team, but also a lot of youth. And that also explains the big changes in form. And you have a lot of players that take a lot of risk on the ball. You know, Hakim Ziyech, it's all or nothing with him. He wants to shoot everything on the goal. He wants to get every pass has to be an assist or some crazy cross thing. And that's typical for Ajax, you know, that they have these kind of players who play all or nothing. You see Frenkie de Jong trying to fool a Benzema in his own box. When everything falls together and succeeds, then it's fantastic. And then they get self-confidence, and then they will do only more. But when it doesn't work out, then there's sometimes some panic against Heracles, against Feyenoord. And then they think, well, let it all go, and we'll see again in the Champions League. I think it's still a lot of up and down. I don't think that they will sustain this form. It's almost impossible.
The Eredivisie had their game postponed to help them prepare for last weekend. From our point of view, that's interesting. The Premier League don't tend to do that. The TV schedules seem to matter. Yeah. Is that a sign that the Dutch league want Ajax to win the Champions League?
Yeah, of course. And it's our only team in Europe left after the winter break. So I think it's logical that you try to do that, because we need the points for the lists to get our clubs automatically qualified for the Champions League. in 2020. So it's absolutely vital that, that Ajax will get these points for our total competition. And you could see they were more fit because Ajax has had I think 5 or 6 players in the World Cup, mind you, as well. So they will be tired now and they could be rested now for a couple of days. Guys like Taliafico, like Ziyech, like Schöne and Dolberg, they were all at the, and Tadic were all at the World Cup. So yeah, that was a really good thing to do.
That team's going to get broken up, though. It's sort of what happens with Ajax. Frankie de Jong's already on his way to Barcelona. De Ligt is linked with loads of big clubs. They seem to accept that's how it is. Does that give them more motivation to go, this? If we're going to win it, we've got to do it this year because none of these players will be here next year?
Yeah, this is an extraordinary group. And talents like Frankie de Jong and Matthijs de Ligt will only come once in 5 or 10 years above. So Tadic said he called from don't leave to his teammates in the dressing room. Said let's stick together and we can do great things, just like Jari Liebmanen did in 95. But Ajax has lifted the salary roof a lot the last couple of years. That's why they could get Daley Blind back and Dusan Tadic. That's why they could keep Hakim Ziyech as well. But they can't compete with the big leagues, the big money, the big salaries, and the structural attendance from a team like Barcelona in the Champions League. So that's why they will lose these players for that money. But they have proved, the technical director, Mark Overmars, especially has proved that that he can fill those gaps and that he's not afraid to put out his neck and and get some big, experienced players back.
Bart, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, no problem.
Bart,
good luck.
Thanks very much. Bart Vlietstra there, Dutch football expert. So Real Madrid then, gentlemen. Sid Lowe's tweet, 7 days, 3 home defeats, 8-1 aggregate score, all 3 competitions gone, one after the other. League Cup, League European Cup, season over on the 5th of March, the day before their birthday. Barcelona now historically better in El Clasico's 96-95, probably the worst week Real Madrid have ever had, Jonathan Wilson.
Yeah, it's definitely the worst week they've had in a long time. I mean, I sort of feel it's been coming as well. I was never convinced of them as Champions League winners, which I know sounds ridiculous given they've won 4 of the last 5. But I never really felt they played that well. They won the moment. You know, they'd score goals when they needed to, or Ramos would do something to stop the opposition scoring, or the opposition goalkeeper would do something absurd, as happened in both the semi-final and the final last year. But the fact is that this side is, assuming they don't win the league this year, which I think we probably can assume, they'll have won the league 3 times in the last 11 years. That's the worst run Real Madrid have had since 1953, which is the first league title after Santiago Bernabeu took over the club. So in what you might think of as the modern Real Madrid, this is the worst ever run they've had domestically. Now, that suggests a team that can't sustain a run, can't actually keep going.
I suppose winning the Champions League 4 times in 5 years is a good way of papering over cracks, isn't it?
Yeah, look, it is. And I saw Miguel Delaney tweeting that they devalued the competition by winning it, which is sort of something that kind of, it's a line we've sort of been saying to each other for 2 or 3 years, because it's inexplicable how Real Madrid keep winning the Champions League, but not very good. Mm. I've kept saying it, and I felt ridiculous saying it, but it is true. And I know I tend to blame Jose Mourinho for everything, but I do wonder whether the ramifications of his falling out with Jorge Valdano when he was Real Madrid manager and getting rid of Valdano, who I'm not sure he had an official role, but he was effectively the director of football, and getting rid of that figure who could have created a sort of long-term plan, you could have been some sort of tempering influence on Florentino Perez's tendency to just buy big-name players. And you could have actually given the squad some kind of philosophy or structure. I wonder if this is the ultimate consequence of that.
And the ultimate consequence of that is that he might get the job again. It doesn't make any sense. Have they not watched Manchester United at the start of this season, Paolo?
Well, who knows? And what a sort of fascinating comeback that would be, given part of his part of what went wrong for Jose last time at Madrid was supposedly his relationship with Sergio Ramos, who spent this game fantastically, having openly almost bragged about getting himself booked in the first leg so that he could miss this second leg and look forward to the later stages. Watched this game while filming a documentary all about himself in the box. I mean, that was quite a moment of footballing. I don't know.
Karma?
Yes, karma, I guess, is the right word. I don't know. I go quite as far as Jonathan with all of the Champions League wins, but I do think, like, last year's Champions League win in particular for Real Madrid, it was the fact they had that game we should probably go through a lot of their games in the knockout rounds last year, but certainly that game against at home to Juventus where they nearly blew a 3-0 lead. Well, they did blow a 3-0 lead and then got away with it because of a penalty at the end. Then against Bayern Munich, basically a backup goalkeeper's mistake lets them get through. Like, there were a lot of warning signs for Madrid along the way, and I think it's very easy to say this all now with hindsight, but the way that Zidane sort of says goodbye, looks at the situation even before the whole, Ronaldo and Gareth Bale are all making their own statements, and just thinks, well, I don't need any more of this. Like, we've taken this sort of probably beyond where we should. Yeah, with hindsight, it all seems very, very clear, but... But certainly, I think, last year's Champions League win is almost hard to explain.
Even the one 3 years ago, they got an absurdly easy run to the final. They played Wolfsburg and were 2-0 down against Wolfsburg. Then they played a Manchester City team who were asleep. And then they got to play Atletico in the final, a team that certainly in European competition, they seemed to have a sort of psychological edge over.
Griezmann missed a penalty in that game as well. Yeah.
But what they had, I suppose, and he's not exactly done what he was supposed to in Turin so far, but what they had during that period was a singular player in Ronaldo who kept resolving games for them. Not every single one of them, but a lot of the stops along the way were resolved by we have to the Champions League's all-time leading goal scorer, and he just scores goals.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's the greatest example of a wider type. I mean, I think Ramos, in a defensive capacity, did a similar thing. I think even weirdly, you look at Modric and Kroos, and there was a semi-final against Atletico 2 years ago. They were both brilliant in a way that I hadn't really seen them be brilliant before. That they had, if you buy loads of good players and stick them together, they have a capacity in one-off games to do brilliant things. But you can't do that over 38 games of a season, and that's why they never win the league.
But that's interesting, because you imagine, Baz, in the summer, it will be fascinating to see what they do, how many new players they bring in for however much money, and who's managing them.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, will their current demise, because they are, have plummeted quite a way, will that put players off joining them? Because players generally go to Real Madrid, for money, let's not kid ourselves, but also because it's pretty much a guarantee you'll win things, and that guarantee maybe isn't there anymore. I saw somewhere on Twitter, some paper, possibly the Times, were saying that it's almost certain Mourinho will go back, which would be a huge relief for Tottenham fans, but I think that would be an awful mistake, but I'd love to see them make it.
I think actually over the last year or two, they have tried to focus on bringing through young players. Mm. So people like Lucas Vasquez, Asensio, Brahim Diaz have just brought in. So there is sort of a nucleus of good young players there. And then you put Mourinho in charge of them.
Gareth Bale's another interesting one, because he's getting so much stick from the Real Madrid fans. And I interviewed his agent the other day, and it was a very strange interview where he'd already said, the Real Madrid fans are a disgrace. They should be kissing Gareth Bale's feet. He's happy to stay at the club, which seemed to me a strange set of... And then I said, look, have you spoken to him? He went, no, I haven't spoken to Gareth. I was like, that seems very strange.
Be out on the golf course. That's...
Well, obviously. And he said that was all, the fact he might have fallen out is nonsense.
Well, I think Courtois has been slightly taken out of context there. I mean, my understanding of that golfer comment was he was asked in one word to sum up a series of players.
Right, okay.
And the word he chose to sum up Gareth Bale was golfer. Yeah. And it was a bit of a joke. And I think that has... I don't think it was as sort of bitchy a comment as it subsequently was made to appear.
But he can't... That's sort of untenable, isn't it, now, that situation? Isn't it?
The Bale situation.
Yeah. But I don't know where he goes. He's on 650,000 a week.
Yeah. I mean, Yes, he is untenable. But equally, I mean, maybe all these players who kind of getting, you know, who can't find a club, maybe they've got to band together and create their own club. You know, Bale and Mesut Ozil, and yeah, they just do world tours, kind of.
And we should, the final one, we should, I know we chatted to Bart about Ajax, but they were so good, Barry, in that game. I mean, they could have scored. I was watching the Tottenham game on the telly, and I had the Ajax game on the laptop, and I just, my eyes were just drawn to watch this team just tearing Real Madrid apart.
Well, they were outstanding, but let's not forget they were also outstanding in the first leg, and they were very unlucky to lose the first leg. I remember doing the minute-by-minute report on that, and it was A, gobsmacked by how good they were, and B, because unlike every other football journalist in the UK, I wasn't aware of how good they were and haven't been closely monitoring their progress for the last 2 years. So, you know, I was behind the curve on that one. Laziness on my part, presumably, because if I'd known all my colleagues were researching Ajax so diligently and watching their every game, I'd have jumped on that bandwagon as well. But, so that surprised me. And then what didn't surprise me, of course, was the way Real Madrid managed to spawn a win, an away win in the first leg. So they dominated them over two legs. And, you know, this is no aberration whatsoever. They were outstanding. And it is a shame that that team won't get to grow together and mature together. But who's to say they won't win this tournament? I mean, it's wide open. Anyone could win this.
Just to pick up on what Baz is saying there about the teams like to get picked apart, I do think it's interesting that they've been able to have this success in a year when actually didn't lose many pieces for once. Justin Kluivert, I think, was really the only headline departure in this past summer, unless I'm forgetting someone. And that's a teenager who hadn't quite had that huge of an impact yet. So it is a team that has got at least a bit of continuity for once, which I think probably also helps when it comes to this point in the competition.
Well, I think bringing in a couple of experienced players in Tadic and Blint, I think that's really helped as well. That there's, you know, there's people for the kids to sort of flow around. But I mean, they were brilliant, and you know, I was watching. I switched over to that game as soon as I scored, and at half time my thought was, I really hope we don't regret all the chances we've missed. But they had just as many in the second half.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, Tadic was brilliant. Van der Beek was brilliant. De Jong was brilliant. But it's also the case they had a lot of space to be brilliant in. I mean, Real Madrid were an absolute shambles.
How many of those Real Madrid players, you know, how big a clear out do they need?
11. Well, okay, not Courtois.
You see, that like there's no one there.
Well, I mean, okay, people like Vasquez, Asensio, Vinicius Jr. Yeah, okay, they're fine. But Modric is gone, right? 33. I don't know if it's just physical weariness or whether mentally, that, you know, doing what he did at the World Cup, whether that's just sort of the top of the mountain for him. Ramos obviously wasn't there, but the fact he wasn't there and his whole behaviour around that suggests, I think, how he's lost a run of himself. Benzema, at what, 31 now, is not what he was. I know he started, yeah, you know, he had a spell early in the season when he looked good, but he's not something you're going to build around for the future. Carvajal got absolutely destroyed by David Neres. You know, Marcelo's not getting in the team now, and he's 29, but I think he's quite an old 29. So yeah, it's a carcass that's been allowed to rot for some time.
Kroos,
what's happened to Kroos? I mean, Kroos obviously had an awful World Cup, but he's only 29.
He looks 35, doesn't he? Running around,
yeah,
like that.
Exactly.
When I was interviewing Bale's agent, he did say Gareth Bale was very frustrated that he was being kept out of the team by Lucas Leiva. Which would be disappointing, wouldn't it? Sticking a holding midfielder up there. Porto 3, Roma 1. Baz, you did the minute-by-minute of this. Did you have a nice time?
I did. It was a very entertaining game, which I suspected would kind of get lost in all the white noise surrounding Manchester United. But it was an epic tie over two legs. And I think Porto just about deserved the win. But They obviously got the penalty 3 minutes of added time or extra time to go on courtesy of VAR. I think it was absolutely the correct decision. Alessandro Florenzi, who was on as a sub, panicked when a cross was coming into the box and had a tug out of Fernando.
He didn't need to do it at all, did he?
I don't think he did, but he's Italian. It's in his nature. The scorpion and the frog. Couldn't help himself, could he?
But I think that's an example of where VAR helps, because I suspect that wouldn't have been given pre-VAR. It's clearly a foul. He's clearly cheated. Yeah. And that's a thing that's very hard for a referee to see, because his body is blocking the fact he's taken the shirt.
It wasn't given. So, yeah, but it was absolutely a VAR.
And players will stop doing that eventually, won't they?
Yeah, that's the thing that I think for all the issues with VAR, and I think there are many, many problems with it, if it changes behaviour, then that's something that's very hard to measure, but it works. And if it stops people pulling shirts at corners and things, that's also a good thing.
I think on the back of this, these quarterfinals, I think Porto are probably the team everyone is going to want in the next round. And they're no mugs. They're a good side. The highlight of this game was undoubtedly Edin Dzeko and Pepe going forehead to forehead in a disagreement over something or other. There was no forward motion or whatever. They were just leaning against each other.
I think
if Dzeko goes down like immediately when they first touch heads, I think he might actually sell it, because Pepe does initiate it. But the thing is, he takes this sort of like 2-3-4 second delay before falling, and that makes it just absurd.
He just keeled over like a tree in a forest that had been chopped down by a lumberjack, and the ref didn't buy it at all. I mean, it was a disgraceful act of simulation, but A, it was funny, and if B, because Pepe was on the receiving end of it, so to speak, you kind of go, hey, I'll give him that one. It was embarrassing.
It was a bit like, I feel like sometimes you see little kids, like toddlers, who fall over, and it's like they have a think about whether or not it's worth crying. Like, it's like they've fallen over and they're not really hurt, but maybe like the sympathy might be worth it if you have a little cry. I felt like it was that moment. It was like, oh, hang on. Was that? Could I get him sent off? It. All right, we'll give it a try. It was
Dzeko, when he keeled over, Pepe didn't even really react. I think inside he was going, why didn't I think of that? And it could only have been improved if they'd both keeled over. That would have been magnificent.
Has Dzeko become a bit of a shithouse recently? Because there's that whole thing with the spitting of the referee business as well.
He also tried to get someone sent off last night. They were already on a yellow.
Pepe?
No, Dzeko.
Someone else. Yeah.
He's having a very odd season. I think last season was obviously magnificent for him. And he it seems like his head's not in the right place at the moment, I would say. And I mean, he missed two extremely presentable chances in extra time that I think Porto deserved to go through, but I think that Roma had, especially towards the end of the tie, they had one where Perotti could have played Zaniolo clean through, didn't. Dzeko had two, as I say, very clear chances in extra time. Roma possibly should have gone through at that point because they had those chances. Just because we were talking about the VAR decisions, and since I know you were watching as well, Baz, did you not think that Schick coming together at the end, I can't remember who it was who clipped him now.
It was Marega, I think.
I thought that was a very tight call. I don't know, because he didn't give it on the field, I can understand saying it's not a clear and evident mistake for the VAR review, but I was still surprised that it didn't go to the TV, to the on-pitch monitor. I thought the replays I saw of it, I thought it looked like he clipped his heel.
I didn't. I thought it was just a dive.
Okay.
And Marega, I mean, maybe I'm biased towards him, but I like Marega a lot. And he is.
Marega was magnificent. Well,
and even though he's on the pitch, is
so
incredible, because he it should be another month before he came back.
Yeah,
and he scored the second goal, didn't he? And he's just a really, really good footballer.
He also apparently, I think, flew out 30 people from his hometown in Mali, isn't it?
I think he was born in France, but he's a Mali international, yeah.
Okay. He flew out for probably like 24 of them kids to come watch him. He seems like an excellent guy, and he was so good in this game, and he was absolutely everywhere. I mean, the fact that he was there, again, I mean, you're talking about someone who's nominally playing up front, but seemed to constantly be winning the ball on the edge of his own area, running the channels. He scored, what is it now, 6 goals in 7 Champions League games. He's been really, really good.
But as you say, it is wide open, and it is fascinating when you just stand back and you look at the teams that have gone through compared to the teams that have gone out. Manchester United, Spurs, Ajax and Porto through, PSG, Dortmund, Real Madrid and Roma out. I wonder, I mean, you sort of imagine, had it been the other way round completely, no one would be surprised.
Well, obviously, no one gave Manchester United much of a chance. Roma, I think, were kind of unlucky. I mean, they have really let themselves down badly in Europe in the past. Paolo will know this more than me, but they lost Daniele De Rossi last night just before half time, and that made a huge difference. And I think Porto just seemed to have just a little edge in fitness levels. But it is wide open, and no one would be surprised if it had gone the other way, those ties.
It's exciting, isn't it? And a sign, obviously, that the Premier League is the greatest league in the world, apart from, of course, the Championship, which is the hardest league in the world, as we know. And we should congratulate Mason Bennett for his goal for Derby. I don't even know how to describe it. It was a kind of overhead volley flick. Yeah. Is that what you'd call it?
Yeah, I think that works.
Okay, an overhead volley flick from Mason Bennett. That was the equaliser. Scott Malone scored the winner late on as they beat Wigan 2-1. Desperately needed that win, Frank Lampard's Derby. They're one place outside the playoffs.
Is that the goal that gets him the Chelsea job?
what, getting the playoffs, do you reckon? Or that Mason Bennett goal?
It's just that goal. It's arrested the decline. And it's very hard to get the Chelsea job if you finish 12th in the Championship. But
could you keep a little tally of the number of times people say that phrase? Is that the moment that gets Frank Lampard the Chelsea job until he gets the Chelsea job?
No, it'd be really dull. I mean,
make spreadsheets about other things that aren't necessarily interesting.
Like what?
Silent witness?
Silent witness isn't interesting. I mean, fuck off.
The Sheffield Derby ended goalless on Monday. Sheffield United are 2 points behind Leeds in second. Sheffield Wednesday fans doing some coin and bottle throwing. Steve Bruce said they hope they find them and punish them. Stop throwing things at people. We'll keep up. We should start that campaign probably if no one else has. The Checker Trade Trophy. Bristol Rovers 0, Sunderland 2. You're on your way to Wembley.
We are. It's very exciting.
Yeah.
39,000 tickets we've got. I've done the pre-registration. It's a very, very complex system. It could be our first trophy since 1973.
Will you take Barry?
I mean, I'd love to take Barry. I honestly don't know if it's going to be possible the way the ticketing is. There's a lot of people who want to go. And, suddenly they're getting regular 30,000.
And Portsmouth will fill the other half of the stadium.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Wembley showdown the 1992 FA Cup final should have been.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the Checker Trade Trophy's got a lot of criticism because of bringing in under-23 sides, under-21 sides from Premier League and Championship sides. This is the final they would have wanted. But it'll be interesting that fans who potentially didn't like the competition will still go because now they're in the final.
Well, I mean, I think the point you keep making is entirely fair, that it's a competition you don't really care about unless you're A, playing Newcastle, or B, in the semi-final. And some have done both this season, so it's great. if you lose in the early rounds, you don't really care. But we're at Wembley, and it's a chance to win something, and football is about that, ultimately.
No, it's about finishing in the top four.
If Sunderland finish fourth in League One this season and don't win the Checker Trade final, that will be a disaster. It's assuming we lose in the playoffs as well. We could end up playing Portsmouth in the playoff final as well.
It's exciting, isn't it? Well, look, good luck to the pair of you and good luck to Portsmouth.
Will Griggs' first goal for Sunderland in open play as well, which I think is a big moment.
Are you suggesting he's on fire?
I was just worried. I thought he might turn into a bit of a Danny Graham figure. But Sunderland have actually been a lot better. I think the Gillingham game was 2-2 at half-time and they scored twice in the second half. I think we may come back. We may come and see that as the turning point for me. If you run a form last since November, we played really well first half against Plymouth on Saturday. Scraped to it a bit second half, but first half we were really good. And I watched the first 15 minutes of Tuesday before having to watch the Champions League. And we looked pretty good in that first 15 minutes. So I hate saying this, but I think they might be all right.
The She Believes Cup, well done to England, who won the She Believes Cup for the first time after a 3-0 win over Japan in Tampa. Three first-half goals, all good goals as well. Lucy Staniforth, Karen Carney, Beth Mead. And the other game, USA beat Brazil 1-0. First time England have won this tournament. They're ranked fourth in the world. They've got to play Japan in the group stages of this summer's World Cup in France, which kicks off on the 7th of June. And by all accounts, they've got a good chance of winning this World Cup. And I was speaking to Emma Hayes, the Chelsea ladies manager, saying, because it's on free-to-air TV, like this, the She Believes Cup has as well, and the World Cup could be a kind of watershed moment for women's football.
I think the and this is going to sound facetious, but it's really not intended that way. A real test of when women's football has properly arrived is when the manager gets slagged off and is forced out of the job for not winning the World Cup. Is at the minute, and you see this, it's not just women's football, but you know, a lot of sports are on absolute mainstream. The journalists who follow it sort of...
are supportive.
Yeah, they have a need to sort of promote their sport. And once that turns, once Phil Neville gets hammered for England going out in the quarterfinal or whatever, that's the moment when it's being treated in the same way men's football would be.
Phil Neville said, we're not going to start moonwalking backwards because people are starting to say we've got a good team and that we're going to do well. We've got to puff out our chest and say, do you know what? This is where we want to be. I don't know if you need to put backwards after moonwalking, because if you're moonwalking forwards, you're just shuffling, right?
I was wondering that. Is moonwalking backwards actually just walking?
So it's a double negative,
yeah,
or a single negative, arguably. Either way, I'd like to see Phil Neville do the moonwalk if England ladies win the World Cup. That'll do for part two. In part three, we'll start by talking to Christoph Winterbach from Der Spiegel about the new allegations concerning FFP and Manchester City. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start with the new allegations from Der Spiegel about Manchester City and financial fair play. We can talk to Christoph Winterbach, sports journalist from Der Spiegel. Christoph, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Can you, as simply as possible, outline these new allegations and what it potentially means for Manchester City?
Well, we published a couple of articles already about Manchester City, and our recent revelation concerns a secret TPO fund, which was used to buy South American players. And Manchester City very much preferred to have their involvement in that TPO fund secret and hidden. So they founded a company in the Cayman Islands and poured money into the scheme via this company. So When they tried to transfer a player using this scheme, the British, the Football Association, asked them about where the money was coming from, actually. And Manchester City failed to declare that they were actually involved in this TPO scheme. So the FA kept asking questions about it, but Manchester City never got around saying that part of that money was actually coming from Abu Dhabi, where the ownership of Manchester City sits themselves.
Have the club responded in any way?
Well, since we published our stories from the Football League's database about Manchester City for a couple of weeks and months now, Manchester City has never commented on our questions. We always notify them before we publish our stories. We let them know what we're going to publish, and we ask them for comment on a lot of questions. And they always refuse to answer those questions. They only say they will not comment on it because it is purportedly hacked or stolen material, and they accuse us of trying to damage the club's reputation. So that's the only response they have ever put out in the public.
If they're guilty of these allegations, what could happen to them?
Well, when you look at the things that happened with the financial fair play regulations, this is a very serious topic, because the UEFA could actually enforce their regulations and exclude Manchester City from their competitions, for example, from the Champions League. And we actually have the chief investigator of UEFA, Yves Leterme, who gave an interview at the beginning of the year. And it's a very rare instance that actually a UEFA investigator speaks out in public while they're actually still looking at a case. And he said, if the allegations are true, then this is a serious problem, and he could actually imagine sanctioning them this hard and excluding them from competitions.
Whenever we talk about this on the podcast, we get some criticism from Manchester City fans saying that we are trying to damage the club's reputation. How are you, as journalist at Der Spiegel, dealing with criticism you get from clubs when you report on things that aren't necessarily flattering for them?
Well, I understand it to some degree. You're very emotionally invested with your club, but I mean, imagine if you meet a fan while you're going to a game or something, and he talks smack about your football club, and you assume he just doesn't like your club, or maybe he's a fan of the rival team. You have those encounters many times. But here, this is like a journalistic research. We looked into this matter and we wrote our articles, and we get the same reaction just as if we were a fan who's talking bad about the football club. So that's the problematic thing for me. This is not the reaction I would expect, because we as journalists, we go so far beyond any allegiances when it comes to those matters. We just see a story and we want to report about it. And I'm open for any discussion as long as people don't start insulting me and like calling me names or saying that I'm a Bayern Munich fan and want to damage every other club. Because frankly, if you ask the Bayern Munich leadership, they would have a laugh about that too, because they're very annoyed by Spiegel coverage as well. So it's a little difficult to always deal with the fan reactions, but it also shows you that those stories matter a lot and that a lot of people are interested in it.
Christoph, has anyone from the Football Association or the Premier League been in touch with you to ask for more information about your findings on this or any other matter you've investigated?
Well, what we always do is when we publish those articles, and beforehand we let them know about our research as well and ask them for a comment. And the football associations are usually very quiet about giving anything out about what they think. We know that at UEFA people were quite annoyed with the revelations about Man City's financial fair play dealings, because Man City received a very favorable settlement in 2014 already. And now UEFA actually finds out that apparently a lot of those facts that they used in this case was misrepresented by Manchester City. So they're very annoyed at that, and they're very careful about saying that in the public. Now they have to deal with the investigations, and it's a big problem for UEFA, for example, because this is not a state prosecutor. They can't march into a club and just seize material. They kind of have to rely on the club cooperating with them. And when they ask the club for handing them out documents, they hope that they will find something that will help them make their case. But so far, they could go to the source of the material, which is, of course, Rui Pinto, the whistleblower of Football Leaks. He handed over this material to us that we're using for our research. But to our understanding, nobody from the FA or the UEFA has contacted Rui Pinto or his lawyer so far about this. So I'm wondering why they wouldn't, because it's a great opportunity for them to look into the internal matters of the clubs.
What's the future of Football Leaks? You don't have to give us all your exclusives. but, you know, will we find out more and more and more things we potentially don't want to know or should know about our football clubs?
Well, this is a lot of material. It's 70 million documents, and we published all throughout Europe with all our media partners over 800 articles already. So we covered a lot of ground already, and I'm pretty certain that there are still storylines to connect in the material that we just haven't even found yet. So it's just impossible to look at every single document. You just have to like look for traces, and maybe if a recent story pops up, you go into the material and see if you find any more clues about it. So definitely, I think at some point there will be more revelations, yes.
Listen, Christoph, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Christoph Winterbach there, sports journalist of Der Spiegel, sticking with Germany. Joachim Löw has axed Mats Hummels, Jerome Boateng and Thomas Müller. He's told Bild 2019 is the year of the new start for the German national team. I thank Mats, Jerome and Thomas for the many successful, extraordinary and unique years we shared. But in the national team, it is now all about laying the foundations for the future. We want to give the team a new face. I'm convinced that this is the right step. The young national players will have the space they need to fully develop, and now they have to take responsibility. Thomas Müller has reacted angrily via his Instagram. Oh, actually, he's done it. If you watch the video, he's very, as you'd imagine Thomas Müller to be, he's not angry, he's just disappointed type thing. He says, the more I think about it, the more the way it was done makes me angry. The coach's sudden decision obviously left me puzzled. A coach must make sporting decisions, no problem. I do not have a problem with that. But it's mostly the character of the decision that I don't understand. Mats, Jerome and I are still able to play at the highest level. The press release of the German Football Federation and its president prepared in advance were, from my point of view, in bad taste and showed a lack of consideration. Hummels is 30, Boateng 30 and Müller 29. Seems quite early.
I think it's really odd the way it's been done. I mean, I'm no great fan of Thomas Müller. I've got an issue with people whose arms are too long. So him and Andy Marr, I think, are the two worst culprits. But
Mr. Tickle, surely you didn't.
Oh
like.
Yeah, oh no, I've got to hate being tickled. Where was I? I was in a childhood nightmare.
Does anybody like being tickled?
Dogs.
I think there's probably fetishists out there. Google it.
Okay.
On incognito.
Let us know below the line if you have a tickle fetish and we'll send Wilson up. Anyway, you're talking about how this has been done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand. This happens quite a lot with international teams. Why does this have to be a permanent thing? I mean, I don't think any of those three have played particularly well recently. So why can't Yogi Löw just say, yeah, I've left them out because I think they're playing well. Maybe in 6 months they're playing brilliantly. I mean, as you said, none of them are old. Mm.
The door is always open seems a sensible form of management, right?
Exactly, yeah. I just seems. I mean, you know, Steve McClaren did it with David Beckham and then end up with egg on his face when he had to go back. I just don't know why you put yourself in that position.
Yogi putting the shaft in manshaft there.
Muller seemed to suggest that he could well be back, which perhaps hints that he thinks Yogi Löw might not be around all that long. Interestingly, I think his last public utterance in relation to the German national team was telling Mesut Ozil that there was no problem with racism surrounding the German national team, which was, you know, good of him. I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for him. He's had a good career. If he doesn't come back, you know, there will be someone to fill his place. And like Jonathan, my memory of him will always be that clip that went viral of him dancing around a nightclub very badly wearing lederhosen with his excessively long arms.
I know, but my body memory of him will be celebrating walking off a pitch in the Champions League final in 2012, shortly before Bayern conceded the comedic equaliser.
You mentioned putting the shaft into manshaft. Of course, the shaft was sung by the Newcastle midfielder, Isaac Hayden, wasn't it? The Europa League
first... straight.
Europa League first legs tonight. Paolo, Arsenal go to Rennes. Are you optimistic?
Well, Ligue 1 have done the same thing that the Eredivisie did for Ajax. I think Rennes have some, you know, spare time over the weekend to get ready for it. So yeah, I think it's every chance it's going to be a tricky tie. But Arsenal are playing better and are, you know, in sort of every tangible sense, you know, richer, more well-structured club to succeed in this tournament. They have better players individually. They should win, but I think Rennes have the potential to be a spanner. Yeah, why not?
Can I just say, I think this idea of delaying league fixtures for European games is an absolute nonsense. I don't know who Rennes should have been playing at the weekend, but imagine they're playing a team who are involved in the relegation scrap. Mm. And that team then ends up at the end of the season having three games in a week because they've had to delay that fixture. So you have to play Saturday, Wednesday, Saturday. And the team may, you know, say that the third of those games is against a direct relegation rival who's then had a week off. Why does that team have to suffer because one of their opponents is in Europe earlier? That's a nonsense. It's a joke. The league's got no requirement to do that. Playing two games in a week is something you sign up for as a professional footballer. Get on with it.
I suppose, yeah, it comes down to an interesting question from the league's point of view of what the league's primary responsibility is. If the league believes that teams going far in Europe raises its profile, brings more money into the league, is it able to put that as its consider its responsibility over sort of protecting each individual club and ensuring a domestic playing field? I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying that's an interesting question.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, but I think internal integrity has always to be the primary responsibility of a competition.
They were due to play Nîmes, who are 11th, so playing for absolutely nothing.
Okay, but Nîmes late in the season could end up having to play three games in a week, and the team they play on the third of those is a team in relegation.
No, strategy. I take your point. It makes perfect sense. I'm with you, Wilson.
Excellent. Glad to hear it.
Chelsea play Dynamo Kiev as well tonight. Premier League games this weekend. The Palace Brighton derby is the early kickoff on Saturday. Cardiff West Ham, Huddersfield play Bournemouth. Leicester Fulham.
I'm going to that one.
Fire. Oh,
yeah. Brendan Rodgers' first home game in charge.
Are you looking forward to it?
Well, it's not as far as a lot of games seem to have done recently. So in that sense, it's quite odd to do a 3 o'clock game on a Saturday. And I've got a Sunday off as a result.
Oh, marvellous. Newcastle play Everton. Spurs go to Southampton with no Pochettino. City Watford, late game on Saturday. Give Watford any hope of upsetting the apple cart?
give them a chance.
Okay. Sunday, three games on Sunday. Midday kickoff for Liverpool, Burnley, Chelsea, Wolves, and then Arsenal, Man United in the race for the top four. Lucas Torreira's three-match ban for his tackle on Danny Rose has been upheld because it was a red card. Also, Birmingham Villa on Sunday. To any other business, in the MLS, I said Stephen Caldwell still played for the New England Revolution, who he never actually ever played for. That's indeed Scott Caldwell, born on the 15th of March 1991, 11 years younger than Stephen Caldwell, who stopped playing MLS in 2015. Thanks to everyone who pointed this out to me, including Stephen Caldwell. Well, someone called Bonerath said, Stephen Caldwell is retired. However, he does have a brilliant podcast called A Football Pod, a weekly podcast starring Christian Jack and Stephen Caldwell, who tweeted, give it a listen. So I will. Hello, Stephen. Ryan says, in the Copa Libertadores game between Palmeiras and Junior Barranquilla, Junior tried to make a sub and the wrong number went up on the scoreboard and it was the wrong player who went off. Is this the only time in history it's actually justifiable to yell at the fourth official?
Do you think Caper was that? That's actually what was going on. No, I can't be right. Like, you know, not me. It must be like number eight or something.
I like the way none of the team's management committee said that's not who we want to come off. Well, he's put the board up. We'll just go with that. Why not?
Well, it happens, doesn't it? You make a mistake, you just follow through with it because the embarrassment is too great.
And finally, the Daily Mirror showbiz editor Mark Jeffries has been in touch. Great to see Wilson back. Can you ask at the end if he or Barry have given BBC crime drama Baptiste a watch yet and what they think of it? I fear it's a bit different to Wilson's faves of Vera and Silent Witness.
It clashes with Endeavour, so no.
I haven't seen Baptiste. My next, sort of murder drama is going to be Shetland, which...
Written by the same woman who did Vera and Cleves.
Okay, I haven't seen those, but... That was going to be my next port of call. But I could give Baptiste a whirl.
I think you should go back to the beginning of Endeavour if you haven't seen the first ones. I think Endeavour's genuinely, it's a level above.
Is Baptiste about Alex Baptiste, who's currently on loan at Luton, but has not played any games yet?
Because he's out solving crime.
That's possible, isn't it? You've not been at training. I've been solving a murder, boss. We don't know. We can only speculate at this stage. But to answer your question, in short, Mark... No. And that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
Cheers.
Thank you, Paolo Bandini.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.